Welcome to WPSU's Vote 18, Race for the 12th District. Today, we're talking with Democrat Mark Friedenberg, the challenger in Pennsylvania's new 12th Congressional District. Friedenberg is a faculty member in Penn State's College of Information Sciences and Technology. Before that, he practiced intellectual property and securities law in New York. Friedenberg got involved in politics after coming out in defense of the Affordable Care Act. Mark Friedenberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Part of your platform is supporting the Affordable Care Act, and you've said that health care is a right that everyone should have, and you want to fight to include that in Medicare.
That's right.
Do you think that that is politically feasible, given how difficult it was to even pass the Affordable Care Act?
I do. I see a lot of support for Medicare for All. Medicare for All is a single-payer program, basically expanding the program that we already have and that most Americans who are on it really enjoy. The Medicare program has 3% overhead versus 31% for private insurance, which a lot of that is profit and administration costs. Many people understand what kind of return they get on that. The dollar spent on Medicare is a lot more efficiently spent than a dollar on private insurance. And on top of that, employers support it too, because rather than them directly contributing to their employees' healthcare costs, that's something that would be paid for by tax in a different way. Divorcing the relationship between employment and healthcare, I think, is really important and will help to revitalize the economy, enable people to move to the jobs that best suit them, rather than being worried about moving and losing their health care or getting sick, losing their job, and then losing health care, which happens all too often.
Even though there are those benefits, there is still a lot of opposition to it. And there are concerns that it could lead to a tax increase or that in the end it could mean less control over your health care. How do you address those? If you were elected, how would you go about that?
You know, I think it's obviously there are important questions to be asked, but I think that the right question is, can we even afford our healthcare system today, let alone in 10 years? Most of the estimates are that we're actually going to be spending far less overall on healthcare under Medicare for All, again, because of that lower overhead. It would involve a tax, that's true, and I don't think that needs to be a dirty word. The take-home pay for most employees is going to be higher, again, because that deduction won't be there. We will have a system that provides healthcare for everybody. And it's important to note this is different than some other European models where the government is the one directly providing the healthcare. Here, this is just about payments. So doctors and mental health providers and dentists and so on, they'll be the ones making decisions about the care that patients receive.
You also support raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
I do.
What would you say to the counterargument that the economy is booming, unemployment in Pennsylvania is at an 18-year low, and you have companies who are stepping up and raising their minimum wage voluntarily, Amazon, for example?
Yeah, I think Amazon is, I don't like to be in the position of relying on Jeff Bezos's largesse, but I think it's actually a good example that the market can support that. If you look at the unemployment rate in Pennsylvania getting historically low, that's wonderful. Nobody can deny that. But wages for people at that minimum wage are often stagnant. I think that Amazon recognizes where the puck is going and they want to be there. I think that if anybody accepts the logic of the minimum wage, which almost every American does, having it $7.25 now is a disgrace. It's so far below what inflation and the cost of living increases would be. A lot of estimates are that it really ought to be around $22 an hour. I think 15 is a statement that if you put in a fair day's work, you should get a fair day's pay.
There's also the argument that the cost of living varies from place to place, even within the 12th district.
It does.
How would you address that?
You know, I think that, you know, the cost of living does vary, but we've adopted a federal minimum wage in the past. We've adopted a state minimum wage. In Pennsylvania, it happens to be the federal. But having the those differences in wages is an important way to compete. All of the states surrounding Pennsylvania have raised their minimum wage above the federal floor. They've all seen lower unemployment and higher wages across the board, which I think is a really important thing. If somebody's dollar can go a little bit further in a more rural district, I think that's great for them. I want to make sure that the economy in our rural communities is strong as well.
The 12th Congressional District stretches from the New York border all the way down to outside of Harrisburg, and it's considered one of the reddest districts in the state of Pennsylvania. You're someone who opposed President Donald Trump. Do you think that you are a good fit for the district?
Yeah, you know, I think that this district is, if you look at voter registration numbers, that does give you one sense of it. Overall, though, it's a non-voting district, really, and that's one of the main things that I'm trying to counter in this campaign is to get people to understand that their vote is so important. Having people realize that the things that President Trump campaigned on that I do support, like $1.5 trillion for infrastructure spending, better, cheaper health care for everybody. This Congress has not been able to deliver them. I think this is a district that's really populist. This is not a very rich district. This is not a district that fares very well on a lot of different rankings with regard to healthcare, with regard to education, with regard to income. I think this is a district of people who could use some help from the government, being able to get that equality of opportunity that people in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, let alone New York or Los Angeles, can try to get. You know, we had Chris Carney, a Democrat representing, this district is new, but the 10th from 2006 to 2010, coming in a wave year, I think there's pretty clear evidence that people will vote for their best interests when they have a clear choice.
You've been very critical of the incumbent Republican Representative Tom Marino, but he won the last election pretty handily. And even though he faced a Republican opponent in the primary, he won that hands down as well. Do you really think that your odds are that you could win?
Absolutely. You know, I don't even think of Tom Marino as the incumbent. We've got a third of this district. The voters don't have Tom Marino as their incumbent. Center County is a big part of that, Clinton County. And I think that for so many people, they're going to take a look at his record, take a look at his involvement with the opioid crisis, and see that he's not really there to represent their interests. And I think that, you know, we have a campaign office, 240 West Hamilton Avenue. We have people coming in every single day to vent about whatever's in the news, a lot of that, and then we put them to work. And if you see the level of energy, the level of enthusiasm, how much time people are committing to this campaign, it's humbling for me, but it also makes me more eager than ever to get out there and deliver a win for them.
One of your big criticisms of the incumbent, Tom Marino, has been legislation that he initially sponsored that many people say makes it harder for the Drug Enforcement Agency to intervene for suspicious shipments of opioids.
The DA itself said that, yes.
If you were elected, what would you do?
Well, I think we need to unwind that legislation. That's a start, and there's already been a bill introduced to do that. I think with regard to the opioid crisis more generally, we need to have a more sympathetic view, have a try to take away the stigma around addiction, because I think for a lot of people, stigma, the feeling that, oh, it's a moral failure on my part, it's a weakness on my part, keeps them from getting the help that they need, whether it's medication or mental health treatment, and it keeps their family members and their loved ones from seeking out that treatment for them. So I think that it's an attitude change that we need. I think we need to understand that medication-assisted treatments are an effective tool, and they're medically proven to be so. And I think we need to make sure that we hold companies like Purdue Pharma that have contributed to this by lying to doctors about the habit-forming nature of their medications are held to account as well. And that's why I'm really glad to see the various lawsuits from state attorneys general and so on that are being brought against those companies.
Do you think that's the most effective way of holding them accountable?
I do. I'm a big believer in the courts. And so for things that have happened in the past, I think that's a good fit for the courts. For things in the future, that's where Congress can play an effective role.
There recently was bipartisan legislation attempting to deal with the opioid epidemic, and it introduces some new things, including funding, more treatment options, changes to regulation, better tracking. It sounds like you're saying that's not enough, though.
I think those are all really, really important steps, absolutely. But it's almost a matter of education. I think it's just the way that we think about addiction needs to change. There are a lot of people who still think of it as somebody who got a prescription from a doctor and happened to become addicted, that is a failing of that person. And I think that's just not the right way to think about it. It's a disease or a sickness like any other, and we should treat it as the public health crisis that it is.
It's one thing to be critical of the incumbent from the outside, but it's another thing when you're in the office and you're the one trying to get things done. How can the voters out there know that if you were elected, you would be able to work across the aisle and take practical steps to get things done?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to look at records, right? Now, this is my first campaign, so I don't have a record of elected office to point to, but you can look at, I think that I've always fought for the little guy or the person who's been wronged in my career. It was true in the legal career. We were suing the banks that caused the crisis. In my work now for teaching, we're trying to do some, I think, really important things, like make sure that we can train students who are going to be able to protect America's cyber infrastructure, protect our utility grid, protect our electoral systems. If you look at where somebody's getting paid, I think that's a pretty important thing, or where their campaign contributions are coming from, more importantly. I know I've pledged to never take a dime from corporate PAC money. My opponent, Tom Marino, seems to be, he only takes corporate PAC money. I think that's a really effective way to make sure that you're accountable to the people who voted for you, or it does take some money to run a campaign, who supported you financially, and not to donors from outside the district who are overwhelmingly corporate interests.
Are there any specific projects that you did either as an attorney or as a faculty member that you think show that you can get results?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the way that I got started in politics was this town hall that I organized last year in the Forum Building at Penn State. And I'm somebody who, this was a week before, it was a time where there was a lot of pressure nationally for every congressman and woman to have a town hall, a forum of some kind. And it was pretty clear that our congressman wasn't willing to do it, so I stepped up and did it myself. I got one together and organized it. I think the transparency that I'm doing throughout this campaign, having open town halls, I'd like to give out my phone number. It's 814-409-7470. Give me a call, and I'll talk to anybody. This is a campaign that's powered by me as a teacher, as a dad who's really worried about the future of this country, by a lot of volunteers who have been helping out. And if people like that, then I think that this is a campaign they should support.
WPSU asked our listeners and viewers for questions, and we got this question from Sherry in Newport, which is now part of the 12th District. And Sherry wants to know, would you support completely eliminating the current cap on Social Security so that all Americans pay Social Security on 100% of their income? Of course, now there is an income cap on what part of your income you pay.
Yes, I do, because the current system now with the cap slightly under $120,000 is regressive. It takes a higher chunk from people who earn less. And I think that is a way we can really guarantee the solvency of Social Security going forward by lifting that cap.
What about the counter argument that if the cap is at $128,000 or in that ballpark, when you get benefits, you are getting the benefits for that amount. So if you're paying on more of your income, you're not getting more benefits.
You know, I think there are a lot of things that we as Americans contribute to that we don't exactly take from in equal measure and equal proportion to what we put into it. I think if you're a believer in the fundamentals of this democracy, if you're a believer in the importance of shared, the shared common good, I think that's an argument that, you know, even most wealthier Americans that I talk to who would be negatively impacted on a narrow basis by that lifting of the cap support it.
You said you think the American government can do more for its people.
Must do.
If you had to pick a priority, if you were elected and you had to pick one area that you were going to focus on, what would it be?
It's got to be healthcare. I mean, we have 30% of the adults in this district have debt that's in collection, most of it medical debt. For the bankruptcies in this district, 2/3 of them are because of medical debt. I think it is, first, a moral failure because we need to take care of each other. Going into the emergency room is not enough if you have, say, a chronic condition. And it's really holding our economy back, too, again, because we have this weird link between employment and healthcare that is keeping people from moving to the jobs that are the best fit for them. And when I see movement, I think the Affordable Care Act was absolutely a step in the right direction. And you saw in 2017 when the House voted to essentially repeal the ACA with no alternative in mind, that they weren't caring about the people in this district. They weren't caring about working Americans. They weren't caring about, we talk about it being about the ACA. A lot of that was just about hundreds of billions of dollars of Medicaid that was going to be cut. That wasn't for anybody but the donor class.
I think the counter argument would be that the ACA forces people to pay for health care who might not have that money to buy insurance and that they shouldn't be forced into that.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you bring that up because the ACA is a complicated scheme with the requirement to have health insurance, the protection for pre-existing conditions, and then subsidies for people who need additional help to be able to pay for the plans. And what this Congress is doing now and what there's a lawsuit from state's attorneys general are trying to do is to take off some of those legs of the stool so that the whole thing is going to collapse. And that is a failing of the ACA, as is the platform of it being on the for-profit insurance system, I think. But it's a lot more important, I think, to look at it globally to say what is it that we can do to make sure that everybody has coverage.
If you're just joining us, this is WPSU Vote 18. We're talking with Mark Friedenberg, the Democratic candidate in Pennsylvania's new 12th district. The new district that you're in includes Penn State University, includes Mansfield, Lock Haven University. What role, if any, do you think the federal government should have in reducing the cost of education?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I have some experience with as a Penn State graduate and as a current Penn State faculty member. And I can tell you, I mean, I see students who are working 40 hours a week, sometimes outside of class. And you can tell that they're not giving it their all, that they're not really able to in the class because they're spending so much time working, trying to pay for Penn State. And I see so many students, too, who come back from years later, they're coming back recruiting, and they're still paying off those debts. And I think the federal government has an important role to play here because we're all better off when we're educated, whether that be at university or some kind of career and technical education. And it is, first of all, for this district in particular, having federal money come in is a good thing, right? I'm here to deliver the goods for the 12th district. But on top of that, it also makes it such that people will want to stay here. I think it helps the economy locally, but it also means hopefully that when students graduate, if they came to Central Pennsylvania, maybe they'll want to stay here. Maybe they like it here and can continue to contribute to the economy in that way. So I'm supporting at least 50% per year, the federal government paying the, you know, co-sharing the tuition with students as long as they stay in each year.
And would there be any other parameters for that? Because it sounds like some people say it's just that's a free gift. Does the student have to have a certain GPA, or do they have to go to certain universities, low-cost universities?
I think as long as the university is willing to let them stay, that's the decision for the university. But it is the best bang for the buck. It's true for K-12, and I think it's true for higher education as well. A dollar on education is one of the best dollars that we can spend.
Would you support putting any type of pressure on universities to bring their costs down too?
You know, I don't. I have some, I have a little bit of an insight onto some of the things that happen in university politics as well. There is probably some administrative bloat that you could point to, but I think that there is, you know, as a faculty member myself, I can tell you that we work really, really hard. We do okay, and so we can't really complain there, but nobody is getting particularly rich in this line of work. It's, you do it because you love it. You know, I took a big pay cut from New York Lawyer to teach at Penn State because I really like it. I wouldn't want to put pressure on the universities. I think we still have the market deciding, because students are going to be paying a high percentage of it. They'll decide where the best, you know, where the best use of their money is.
Even among those who've been critical of President Trump, there are some who support him taking a tougher stance with China on trade. Do you think that that's a good position to take?
I guess it depends what tougher is. I think these tariffs are a disastrous idea. They are attacks on the American consumer. They are holding back our economy by picking winners and losers, which is the exact opposite, I think, of what most conservative economists have talked about for decades, picking winners and losers, free trade being good for us. And, you know, I teach a globalization class this semester, and students are having a hard time even understanding why would a country do this to itself. The United States is doing this to itself. We are further isolating ourselves from the rest of the world. Economically, we're doing it by withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement, from the Iran deal, by calling into question our NATO obligations. The U.S. is withdrawing from the world, and that's going to have grave consequences. I'm very worried about the state of our institutions, the global institutions, U.S. institutions. You know, I think today we're having we're seeing the Supreme Court and the Senate legitimacy being called into some question, ongoing attacks on the press. But to the basic question about China, no, I don't think it's a good idea. It's easy. You know, President Trump said that trade wars are good and easy to win. We're not there. We're going to lose this trade war.
Some supporters would say that it's going to benefit the United States economically, and they would point to the economy as it's doing now.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're lucky that we have some headroom built in because the economy is doing well. I think it's holding us back, and there's really no winner here. Our global supply chain, our economy now, is so tightly integrated with the rest of the world that when we put up these hurdles, I think other countries are just going to look abroad from the United States for trading partners. They're going to leave us in isolation.
Some Democrats are calling for an end to ICE, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, and that supports deportation of unauthorized immigrants. Where do you stand on that?
I don't support abolishing ICE. I think it's an important law enforcement agency, but this is, I think, one of the main failings of this Congress is it hasn't performed its oversight role. There's a lot more to Congress than just what laws do you vote on. You provide oversight and make sure that the money that Congress has authorized is being spent right, and that the law is not exactly being applied right, but that the regulations are being followed and the money is being spent well. ICE is one area that I think we need a lot of oversight. There are many others as well. We need Congress to serve as a check constitutionally, as it's required to do on the other branches.
In a video statement about Russia and whether or not it's been tampering in our elections, you said of your opponent, quote, he doesn't have the expertise or the energy to focus on what needs to be done. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm I teach in the College of Information Sciences and Technology, law and policy courses and technical courses as well. I'm 34 years old. I grew up in this world, and I understand from the ones and zeros on up how the internet works and the kinds of threats that we face, not only purely technical threats, but the social media and disinformation threats as well. My opponent simply doesn't have that background. Recently, I think he was shocked to discover that we don't have great broadband throughout the district. These are serious problems that I think require, I think anybody can run for Congress. You don't need to be an expert in any particular area. I think that's important. But I think if you have expertise, it makes you attuned to the gravity of the risks that we're facing. And this is a serious one.
And you said you want to protect Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. In another 20 years or so, Social Security isn't going to have the funding to fully pay for itself if nothing changes. What, if anything, would you support to ensure that it does have the funding?
You know, I think Social Security is a promise that we have made to our future selves and that we've made to the generations that came before us. And so I don't think we can make any reductions in what's been promised, because that's breaking the promise. I think lifting the cap, like we talked about before, is an important step to improve solvency.
And small farms in Pennsylvania are facing a tough market right now and dropping prices, which could lead to the closing of some farms. What do you think Congress should be doing?
Yeah, and there are a lot of farms that are closing. And I went a couple of weeks ago to a dairy farmers crisis hearing that was the farmers themselves put it together, and they wanted to put on the record what they see as the major problems that they're facing and to convey the magnitude of the really despair that they feel closing farms and making it much harder for them to get their to make ends meet. So on a short-term basis, I think where the local government or state government or the market fails, that's the role of the federal government. I think the federal government has your back when everything else has gone wrong, when you've done everything right, like most farmers have done, and prices, for example, keep falling. And so I support what a lot of farmers have asked about, which is an emergency price floor. We've done this before in America. $20 per hundredweight of milk. Combine that with longer-term supply management program, because a lot of what we see as driving prices down now is because of oversupply, and there's a number of reasons for that. But if we can help to control supply longer-term and help keep the farm open now with a price floor, I think that's an important step.
Do you support what President Trump did renegotiating with Canada on the former North American Free Trade Agreement? And part of that was the market for milk.
Yeah, you know, I think it's globally, I'm not too happy when America just decides to up and renegotiate promises that we've made. I think that lowers our standing in the world. This particular deal, my understanding of it is that there aren't huge changes to NAFTA. That it is, there are some things about dairy pricing, for example, and making trade more fair there. But that's just one trading partner of many that we have.
Would you support legalizing marijuana at the federal level? Of course, that's something that states have stepped in and done at the state level, but it's still a narcotic illegal at the federal level.
I do support legalizing marijuana, yeah. And there are a couple of reasons why, but really the main one is what's the reason to have it be illegal? And I just don't see it. I think as a matter of freedom, as a matter of liberty, if there's not a great reason to, you know, to ban something, then we ought not to.
I think the counter argument would be that marijuana for younger people in particular can be the so-called gateway drug, and it's not good to allow that to get into the hands of young people more easily.
That's just not true. Yeah, I think we have a lot of history to show that.
What about the possibility that if it were more available, that it could be more available to young people, too?
It's already fully available to young people. It is a sort of a backward-looking approach that we have now. Let's reflect, you know, let's try to focus on what are the actual problems that we have for young people. I'm more worried about them getting an education, getting a job, staying in Pennsylvania. Marijuana is, it's not the main issue that we're facing. And I think for a lot of people, you know, there's research that's being done into it being as an alternative to, opioid painkillers. I don't know what the science will say on that, but I'm glad that people are looking into it.
Would you want to overturn the tax cuts that President Trump signed into law that you were critical of?
I was, and here's why. You know, with the $1.5 trillion, we could have given a check for $5,000 to every American. That would stimulate the economy in a real way. That is somebody who's barely getting by month to month their quality of life would markedly improve. If you give $1,000 to, say, a Jeff Bezos, no change whatsoever in the economy. That's real stimulus. That's something that we can do to reward hardworking Americans and to recognize the work that they do. Giving temporary, much smaller cuts to working Americans and much larger permanent cuts to corporations and the wealthiest Americans is not the way to go.
Your opponent has said that he supports term limits, but I've read that you do not support term limits. Why not?
Yeah, I don't. And I'll be honest, this is probably one of the areas that I disagree with a lot of the folks who come to events and when I knock on their doors. I think we have elections every 2 years, and so you can vote the bum out if you don't agree with what he's doing. But the larger issue is, I think, campaign finance reform. That's the bigger problem, that people want to know that they're accountable in some way, and not that the congressman or congresswoman isn't, again, appealing to the interests of out-of-state elites. And I think if we can have campaign finance reform, I've supported overturning Citizens United by constitutional amendment. I think public financing of elections so that elected officials and candidates can spend their time campaigning or governing and not raising funds, I think those are important reforms that would help to, I think, address the same concerns that people have about term limits.
And we talked a little bit about broadband access. Your opponent, Representative Tom Marino, has introduced legislation offering incentives for businesses to invest in broadband to hopefully bring more access across Pennsylvania and the country. Would you support that idea?
I think that's a good small step, but there are a much larger set of problems. And I think the main one is that we just don't have competition. So if you're in, say, State College, you can have Comcast or nothing. That's the choice that you have. This is unlike almost any other consumer choice that we have. If you go to buy toothpaste, it's a dizzying array. But for internet, there's just the one provider. If we enforced our antitrust laws that we already have on the books, if we had competition, I think you would see much lower prices, much higher speeds like in the rest of the world. And then for the folks who don't have service at all right now, where Comcast, it will never be economically feasible for them to, or at least in their view, to run cable to your home. Sure, we can provide some incentives there. I would like to see there be the government actually being the one to provide the cabling and to provide the internet service. I think that is, it's such critical infrastructure. In the same way that the founders thought it was so important, they put it in the Constitution to have postal roads and a postal system. I think it's just as important, probably more so today, that we guarantee that everybody have access to the internet.
We have less than a minute left. Voter turnout in midterm elections like this is generally very low. And there was a recent NPR report and poll that enthusiasm among Democrats is sinking. What do you see yourself doing to counter that?
You know, I go around and I just try to say, hey, I'm somebody who thinks that things are broken, and I decided to get involved. And I think people respond to that. And I decided to get involved for my own reasons. And I say that as somebody who's been pretty lucky in life. I can't deny that. There are big concerns that I have. But I think what I've learned throughout this campaign is that there are people who have much bigger concerns than I do. And they have been beaten down. They have been ground to dust. They have lost all hope for what the government can do for them. They think the American dream is dead. I don't believe that. And I think we have an obligation to make sure that we take care of them. We take care of each other. It starts on November 6th.
Mark Friedenberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Mark Friedenberg, the Democratic candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 12th Congressional District. Next, we'll speak with his Republican opponent, Tom Marino.